The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Ian Rankin. He joins us on the telephone in Florida. Hello, Ian.
Hey, Vic.
Ian, you finally decided to come back to America, and this is kind of a big year for you, isn't it? Didn't you publish your first John Rebus novel 30 years ago in America?
Yeah, it's been 30 long years for me and the fans both. And who knew? I mean, I certainly had no idea when I wrote the first one that I would still be writing these books 3 decades later.
Well, you tried to stop.
I did several times, man. I mean, at the end of the very first book, in the first draft, he's shot and killed. And for whatever reason, in the second draft, I changed that so he survived. And that turned out to be good luck. Then after 17 novels, he hit retirement age at the end of Exit Music. So I thought that was me done with him then. But he always finds a way to come back. He's, he's a bit like the mummy in those old movies. You just can't stop him. He keeps on coming.
You killed him off in your initial draft?
Well, I didn't think I was going to be a mystery novelist back then. I was going to be a literary novelist. I didn't read crime fiction, mysteries, per se, so I didn't know you could have a series or, that you could keep this thing going. And I just thought this guy's, like other characters I wanted to write about, he's only with me for the one book. So it didn't matter too much to me whether he was alive or dead at the end, because I wasn't intending to go back to him. And, I mean, I didn't. When that first Rebus novel was published, to no acclaim or sales whatsoever, I then went off and did a spy novel and a thriller, thinking I was done with him, guy. And it was my editor who said, look, I like that guy, Rebus. Why don't you bring him back? And by that time, by that stage in my career, I had become a fan of the mystery novel, and I liked what it could do, what it can do, with sense of place, with character, taking on big themes, giving the reader an exciting storyline, all of that. I knew I wanted to write about Edinburgh, past and present. I wanted to write about people on every layer of society, every stratum of society in Edinburgh. And I thought, well, a cop is a good way of doing that, so why don't I bring this guy Rebus back? So it was just my editor saying, why don't you bring him back? That was what did it.
You weren't attached to Rebus, but apparently your editor grew attached. And I'm wondering, in that initial draft, how did you kill him? Who killed him? Was it Cafferty? Did Cafferty murder him?
No, Cafferty wasn't in the series until book 3. He had a very, very small part, a cameo in book 3, only because I needed to get Rebus to Glasgow to find a clue. And I thought, why is he in Glasgow? Oh, he's given evidence. Who's he given evidence against? A gangster. Who's the gangster? And up pops Morris Gerald Cafferty. No, I mean, at the end of the, spoiler alert, at the end of Knots and Crosses, the first Rebus novel, there's a chase scene through some tunnels beneath the library in the center of the city. And Rebus in the first draft was shot and killed by the killer. And then in the second draft, he's wounded, but he makes it.
Mm. Okay, well, you've published a new one in the U.S. It's just come out. It's called In a House of Lies. And I guess we should probably explain to some of our listeners who haven't been keeping up with the series that Rebus did retire and that you had a hiatus there and then you brought him back. Tell us how you were able to figure out how to bring him back.
Yeah, I mean, he retired because he reached the retirement age in the real world in Scotland. And I thought, that's me done. And I invented a new detective, Malcolm Fox, internal affairs detective, and I was quite happy writing about him, and I wrote some standalones as well. But then I got an idea for a cold case. And there is a unit in Edinburgh that investigates cold cases, and it's staffed by retired detectives. And I thought, well, that's what Rebus would be doing. So rather than invent a new character who happens to be a retired detective, I used the one I already had. So that seemed to fit pretty well. And then they started to talk about changing the retirement age for detectives in Scotland. So I brought him back into the police for a book or two. And then he retired again, and that's him now. So, you know, the challenge for me now is how do you get this guy who's no longer a cop, how does he get himself involved in current police investigations? And that is a challenge for me as a novelist, but that challenge, I think, keeps the series fresh, and it keeps it exciting and fresh for me because this is uncharted territory for me. And, you know, the challenge is to make the reader believe this could happen, that this guy could still get involved in a police inquiry. I mean, the latest book, it was a godsend in a way because it's very loosely based on a real case. A private detective 30 years ago in London who was investigating alleged ties between senior police officers and organized crime, and he was found hacked to death in a pub car park. And I got the notion of a private detective in Edinburgh who's been poking his nose into something he shouldn't, and he has gone missing, and 10 years later his body turns up. And I thought, okay, so we've got a current murder inquiry in the present day, but the police would also go back and look at the original missing person case to see if there was malfeasance or whether the police were corrupt or they just were lazy or why didn't they spot this guy's body in his car, etc., etc. I thought, oh, hang on a minute, that's Rebus. Rebus was a cop 10 years ago, so he could be the one under investigation this time around. So that, you know, seemed very, I don't know, it just seemed like an organic thing that it was meant to be a Rebus novel. When I started thinking about it, the first few, you know, days I was thinking about it as a plot, I was thinking about it as a story for my ongoing detective, Siobhan Clark. I didn't think there was a place for Rebus until I got the notion of this guy having been gone missing for 10 years, and suddenly it's a Rebus book.
Ian Rankin joins us. His new novel is In a House of Lies. How many books has it been since you unretired Rebus? Two, three, four books?
Let me think. One, two, three, four.
Okay. Well, in this one, it's the first time that, as a reader, I felt like he sort of acted like he was retired. Sort of.
Yeah.
And they really want to keep him out. They really don't want him sticking his nose in the police business, but he's very much a part of this case, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's now in a position where he walks into a police station and the guy behind the front desk says, "Yes, sir, can I help you?" And Rebus goes, "Well, yeah, I was a cop for 30 years. I used to work here." And the cop behind the desk goes, "So what? You know, you're a civilian now." And Rebus wants to get upstairs and talk to the detectives, but he's not going to get past the security. He's got to phone upstairs and see if someone will come down and let him in. So he's very much aware that he's no longer a cop, but he still has the same instincts that he had back then. He still has the same skills for just burrowing and not letting anybody get in his way or deter him from getting to the root of the problem or getting to the truth of the investigation. And because he's no longer a detective, that gives him a certain freedom. He doesn't have to follow the rules anymore, the rules and regulations. He can do his own thing. So, you know, there are problems for him, but there are also opportunities for him as a civilian that he didn't have as an actual cop. So he's more like a private detective, I guess. It's just he's not getting paid for the privilege.
Okay, so Rebus was involved in the initial investigation. It was basically a missing persons case because this guy just disappeared, this private eye. Can we talk about how he's discovered, or should we just leave that alone?
Well, he's discovered in the first few pages of the book, so it's no mystery, really. It's some kids, pre-high school kids, and they've got some vacation time, and they're in the woods with their bikes, and one of them shoves another one down into this deep gully, and they're covered up by all kinds of kind of bracken and weeds and everything else. Is an old rusting VW car. And in the trunk of the car, they find the kind of skeletal remains of the missing person. And, you know, that the woods where the car was were searched originally, which is why the police are a bit concerned that the police originally who searched the woods didn't find the car. So that's why questions start to be asked. And it's an internal affairs matter. So that brings in Malcolm Fox, my internal affairs cop, as was. So he's dispatched to Edinburgh to look into the original case and see if mistakes were made or were corrupt cops involved who were covering up the disappearance. Because this guy was investigating some pretty high-powered people, business people with kind of, again, with links to potentially organized crime. So all kinds of reasons why he could have been killed. And when I started the book, I mean, Vic, you know a little bit about how to write. When I started this book, I had no idea who killed the private detective or why. The first draft of the book, The Inquiry, was me knowing as little as my main characters as they went about their business. And during the course of that first draft, I worked out who the killer had to be.
It's true, Ian. I was as surprised as you were to find out who the killer was.
Yep. Well, that's good. I mean, I always reckon if I start a book not knowing who the killer is, maybe the reader won't know either.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's just a lot of writers would be terrified at the notion of starting a mystery novel. You've got the body, but you've no idea who did it or why. But more mystery novelists than you might think work that way. A lot of us pretty much make it up as we go along. And we start to see that the book, the story, has a notion of where it wants to go. It's got a much better sense of where it wants to go than the novelist. And basically, we writers just have to kind of hang on there for dear life while the story takes us towards the conclusion it wants.
Ian, you mentioned that when you put this series on hiatus for a while, that you started a new one with Malcolm Fox, who was with The Complaints, the Scottish Internal Affairs, and you've done a really great job of seamlessly bringing him into the Rebus series. And his relationship with Rebus is an important dynamic in these stories. I think Malcolm is slowly beginning to respect old John Rebus.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, having invented Malcolm Fox, who is a very different kind of cop from Rebus. He's a rule follower by nature. He always, you know, is on the right side of the law, doesn't make mistakes, very cautious and careful, whereas Rebus is the kind of typical bull in a china shop. You just let him go and see what happens. But when I brought Rebus back, I thought, well, there's one person I can think of who wouldn't want a dinosaur like Rebus, that kind of cop, back in the police, and that's Malcolm Fox. So Fox became the antagonist in that Rebus comeback novel. But then I discovered that you're only a complaints officer and internal affairs cop for a certain number of years, and then you go back into normal detective duties. And I thought, whoa, when Fox goes back into normal detective duties, he's going to be surrounded by cops he has investigated, cops who don't trust him, cops who don't like him because he's the cop who used to bust the cops. So he's going to need friends and he's going to need allies very quickly. So having gone from being antagonistic towards Rebus, suddenly he has an empathy for Rebus and he needs him to a certain extent. And I think he does, he likes, you know, he admires certain aspects of Rebus, the fact that he is on the side of the angels, that he you know, he's always doing maybe the wrong thing, but for the right reasons. And he's completely dogged in his work. You know, if you give him a case to work on, I mean, in this book, Siobhan Clark has a kind of almost a personal case that she hands on to Rebus so she can focus on the murder inquiry. And you give that to him, and he's happy, and he will just keep going at it. He won't let it go until he gets satisfactory answers.
You're referring to our second murder mystery?
Yeah, I mean, there's a teenager who's been put in jail for the stabbing and murder of his girlfriend, and his uncle doesn't think he did it, and his uncle has some power over Siobhan Clark and asks her to kind of reopen the case, not officially, but unofficially, and so she hands that over to Rebus, knowing that it's the kind of thing that he could really get his teeth into, and also keep him out of her way while she's investigating the murder of the private detective. Mm-hmm. So that takes Rebus into the lives of this kind of fairly chaotic family, kind of blue-collar family with a lot of dysfunction. And, you know, in A House of Lies, the title of the book, there's kind of several meanings to it. The police headquarters in Edinburgh used to be called the Big House. And you get the sense that all the cops who used to work there a decade ago and more were all keeping secrets from each other in the world at large, were all lying to a certain degree, lying to their superiors, lying to themselves about their real motives. And then there's also this home, this dysfunctional family who also have been telling a lot of lies to each other and to the media and to the world at large about what happened the night the teenager's girlfriend was killed.
Is it also a song lyric? I was trying to figure
it's
that out.
Big. It's a rare occasion for me, man. I got the idea for the title very quickly, but it isn't a song lyric. But
okay.
In a twist, because normally my books, the titles are taken from songs or misheard lyrics or album titles. But in a twist with this one, I'm in a band, a kind of 50-something dad band. We just get together and rehearse every now and again. We don't do too many gigs. But I've written some lyrics, and we've now got a song called In a House of Lies.
Oh.
So, and it, the lyrics don't at all refer to the story in the book, but I now have a song called In a House of Lies that came after the book rather than before the book.
Musical reverse engineering.
Yeah, there you go.
You're listening to The Book Nook. We'll be right back. Ian Rankin joins us. We're talking about his new Rebus novel, In a House of Lies. And Siobhan Clark has been Rebus's protege. He's been her mentor. And as this book opens, there's a bit of conflict, a bit of bad feeling between Siobhan and a couple of internal affairs officers. And these guys, I love these characters, these two internal affairs guys. Can we talk about them at all?
Yeah, they've got the nickname the Chugabugs, which is from Wacky Races, the Arkansas Chugabug. If you remember the Wacky Races, you're too young for the Wacky Races cartoon show. It used to be on TV, Dick Dastardly and Muttley and all that lot. I used to love it when I was a kid, man. I loved it. I can never understand why Dick Dastardly, having the fastest car, because he could always get like 20 minutes ahead of the rest of them in the race, he would then stop to set up some kind of, you know, Rococo scheme so that they would fail. And I'm saying, Dick, just keep going, man. You'll win this race. You've got the fastest car. But no, his hubris always got in the way. Anyway, so I named these guys the Arkansas Chugabugs, which was a kind of a redneck and his bear who sort of rattled along in a kind of wooden jalopy as part of the Wacky Races show, TV show. Uh-huh. So there's two internal affairs guys. One of them is quite sharp, and he's sharply dressed. Another one's a big lumbering sort of guy that doesn't say much if he talks at all. He's like the muscle. And they were beat cops back in the day when the private detective went missing. So they were kind of working the inquiry alongside Rebus, although not of much contact with him because he was a detective and they were just uniformed officers. But they've now risen through the ranks and become internal affairs cops. And, they've got there by slightly nefarious means, I think we could say. And they know where the bodies are buried, if not literally and then certainly metaphorically.
I love these two guys. The book is In a House of Lies, and Ian Rankin is on book tour. And you took last year off in a way, didn't you? You had your 30th anniversary for Rebus over in the UK, and you were busy last year, weren't you?
Yeah, I was busy. I mean, I also co-wrote a stage play, a Rebus stage play, a brand new story, and it's Rebus and Cafferty and Siobhan Clark and a kind of triangular relationship with lots of tension and lots of game playing between the three of them. And so that was premiered in the UK in the summer. So I was quite busy with that. It's still touring. It toured up until Christmas and then, more theaters wanted it. So it's on tour again now with a slightly revised cast. But that was really interesting to see Cafferty and Rebus in three dimensions on stage squaring up to each other. So there was that, and yeah, I was doing a bunch of other little projects. I mean, there's a TV reboot perhaps going to be next year, so I wasn't writing the script, but I was involved in the negotiations over that. The 2-hour pilot already written, and we're just waiting to see if it'll be greenlit or not. A bunch of stuff, man, a bunch of stuff. And, and singing with my band, of course, going into the studio. We cut a 7-inch single last year.
Oh.
I think it sold probably 100 copies in total around the world.
Wow.
I've seen one on U.S. soil. I signed one for a guy a few days ago. So all of that's been going on, and it's been hectic. And, I've got a deal that means I've got to write one more book. And actually, just at the start of this tour, I got a glimmer of an idea that I think might be my next plot. So it is nice to come on tour because you sort of empty your mind when you're in a new place, and ideas can come flying at you from anywhere.
So you'll probably be heading up to the Bolt Hall in Cromarty, eh?
I've got a little fishing village north of Inverness, way up in the north of Scotland, and we've got a little house up there with no cell phone signal and no TV. And that's where the first 100 pages of In a House of Lies were written. I got the idea when I was on vacation last January, came back to the UK, jumped in the car with my computer and went up to this little fishing village, plugged in the computer and just started writing, and wrote first 100 pages in about 10 days. Rough and ready, first draft, but at least by 10 days I thought, yeah, this could work. This story could work. Problem with not having done a lot of structure or a lot of planning before you start writing the book is you're always worried that, you know, it won't go very far. You'll get maybe 30, 40 pages in and go, I've got nothing else. That's it. But it almost wrote itself, man. It was so good. And the other thing I enjoy is, you know, Rebus, again, to keep the series fresh, you know, the police keep changing, the structure of the police in Scotland keeps changing, the way they investigate crimes changes, Edinburgh changes, but Rebus himself keeps changing before my eyes. And in this book, he's got COPD, he's got what used to be called emphysema, a disease, and he's very aware of his own mortality. And so when I sat down to write the book, he had changed from the previous book. And that keeps the series fresh, and that's a challenge. That keeps me on my toes, and it means that I'm really as interested in this guy as I was 30 years ago when I started the series.
And we mentioned Big Jer, Jerry Cafferty, the Edinburgh crime boss, earlier in the interview, and he's back in this one. He's kind of like Rebus. He just really cannot retire completely, can he?
It's true. I mean, they've got very similar kind of parallel lives. The world is kind of saying to them, look, you're of a certain age, you should be stepping aside. There are younger, hungrier criminals out there vying for Cafferty's crown, just as there are young, intelligent, sparky cops eager to take over from people like Rebus. But they're, you know, Rebus and Cafferty have got this empathy. They look at each other and they sort of recognize something in each other, which is this question about, do they still make a difference to the world? Is there still a place in the world for them or for people like them? And Cafferty's got everything. He's got the city back again from the young pretender who used to run Edinburgh, and he's kind of there in his penthouse apartment looking out across the city, and he's still not satisfied. He's still not completely happy, and he's wary. He's fearful. He doesn't know where the next pretender is going to come from, where the next person is going to come from who's going to try and take him down. So that's, I think that's really interesting, that relationship between the two of these guys who've known each other for so long, been adversaries for so long. And it's hard, each finds it really hard to imagine life without the other. I think that's at the crux of it.
It's the Book Nook. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And today, Ian Rankin returning to the program to talk about his latest novel, In a House of Lies. And I've been having a tough time reading here the last few days. I put it off for a while, but I just couldn't put it off any longer. I've been reading an advanced copy of Philip Kerr's last novel.
Oh, man.
And, it's really tough to read because I love his stuff so much, and I enjoy it so much, and it's just painful to think that this is it. It's over.
Yeah. And I don't think the American edition will have it, but his publisher and his widow asked me if I would write an introduction to the UK edition. So I got sent an early copy of it as well. And, you know, I mean, I didn't know him hugely well, but we'd met a few times. I'd interviewed him at mystery festivals. We'd had dinner a couple of years before. We'd talked about maybe doing something together, maybe doing a film or something for TV. We kept in touch. And, yeah, I was as shocked as anybody when he died. And strangely enough, Vic, we're downsizing. My wife and I, we're moving from a big Victorian house into an apartment, and as part of that process I had to go through a lot of my papers because I was donating my archive to the National Library of Scotland. And when I went through, there was all this correspondence with all these authors who are no longer with us. I mean, two things: one, the authors are no longer with us; two, correspondence. I mean, this might be the last generation where writers actually wrote letters to each other. So I found letters from Philip Kerr, from Ian Banks, from Ruth Rendell, Reginald Hill, P.D. James, William McIlvany. They're all gone. They're all gone.
My. Well, I didn't realize. I interviewed Philip six or seven times, and I didn't realize until maybe the third interview that he was actually originally from Scotland, because he didn't really claim it, and he didn't really have that accent into my ear.
No, he didn't at all. I mean, he went to a kind of, you know, posh private school in Edinburgh, and I think he really didn't much like his time in Edinburgh. He wrote one vitriolic short story called The Unnatural History Museum, which was a about Edinburgh. And if you ever get a chance to read that short story, wow, he really stabs Edinburgh right in the neck. So I think he had unhappy memories of his school days and all the rest of it. But he was Scottish, and he was versed in things like Robert Louis Stevenson and Jekyll and Hyde and the historical novel that Scotland used to be famous for, people like Sir Walter Scott, for example. And, I mean, that was part of his upbringing. He couldn't escape it. And it's one of these things that, you know, once you're Scottish, that's you. You are Scottish. And we'll claim you. We're not going to let you go.
One of the many things I love about your character, John Rebus, is his encyclopedic musical memory. And we're treated to some of that near the end of the book when he starts going down his memorization of B-sides of Rolling Stones singles. I was tickled to read that, and I cannot interview you, Ian, without asking you a little bit about music. What are some of the hot recordings that you've heard lately that you really liked?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, my album of last year is a Scottish artist called Catherine Joseph, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, and she plays an old rickety upright piano, and it's just a guy with drums with brushes beside her, and it's just the two of them. But she's completely captivating as a live performer. She really fixes you, and you feel like it's just you and her in the room. And her later album from last year, her second album, I don't know, imagine a kind of Scottish, experimental, blasphemous Kate Bush. And you're getting kind of close.
Blasphemous.
So that was great. And then just recently, before I came on tour, I bought the new album by another Scottish band called The Twilight Sad. And The Cure, Robert Smith and The Cure have become big fans of The Twilight Sad, and The Twilight Sad have been touring with The Cure. And there is something of The Cure, kind of 80s, 90s Cure in the Twilight Sad sound. Impassioned lyrics, a great singer, really interesting lyricist, and just a big powerhouse sound, but with a lot of emotion in it. So there's a couple of tips for you.
You mentioned that you're in a band again. Have you got the same name as your original band?
No, the band I was in when I was 19 were called The Dancing Pigs.
Okay.
They've gone. And my band I'm in now are called Best Picture, as in like the best picture Oscar goes to. And we also have a song called Best Picture, but we've not actually recorded that yet. But we've got about five or six songs we're happy with. I mean, we're, you know, like I say, we're just a bunch of guys in their 50s who like to get together and just sit in a room and noodle and practice. But we do have one professional musician, Robert, Bobby Bluebell, we call him. He is in a band called The Bluebells, who had a huge hit years ago with a song called Young at Heart, which crops up now and again on adverts and in films. So Bobby from The Bluebells is our rhythm guitarist and backing singer. So he tells us when we're doing something that's pretty good.
All right.
And so far, in a couple of years of existence, there's not been that much.
You mentioned a TV show. This is the second Rebus TV show?
This would be the third incarnation if it happens. I mean, two actors had a go at Rebus. John Hannah originally did it before he went off to Hollywood, and then an actor called Ken Stott took over.
Uh-huh.
But they started off as two-hour television films, and they took it down to 1 hour, which is basically 45 minutes per book, and I just didn't like that format. I didn't like how much of the book they were having to get rid of to make it work. So I got the rights back, and it sat for a while not being filmed, but a TV company last year said, look, we'd like to do it justice. We'd like to do it long form over maybe 8 or 10 hours. So we got a scriptwriter involved. He's a stage dramatist and also a screenwriter, and he has done a two-hour pilot, and we're very happy with the two-hour pilot, and it's gone to the BBC. And if the BBC don't like it, we'll take it elsewhere. We'll try Netflix, Amazon, you name it. We'll try it, because I think he's written a fantastic two-hour pilot for what could be 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours of great television.
And you're actually watching it?
Well, will I watch it? I don't know.
Okay.
I did watch the stage play, you know.
Right.
You know, the Rebus stage play, I didn't have any difficulty with that at all. Maybe because that's just a one-off. Whenever it was on TV originally, I never used to watch it because I didn't want actors to start interfering with the voices and the ideas that were in my head. So I don't know if I would watch it this time around.
Just checking.
I don't know. Wait and see.
I actually liked Ken Stott in the role.
I like him as an actor. Yeah. And I thought physically he was probably pretty good for the part.
Yeah.
For the stage play, it was interesting because the producer said to me, hey, we've got this great television actor. He's in Coronation Street, this really long-running soap. He's called Charles Lawson. And I went, what, Charles Lawson? Isn't he Irish? And he went, oh, yeah, he's from Belfast, but don't worry, you can do a Scottish accent. And so sure enough, I went along to the opening night, the world premiere, and the guy who plays Big Jim McDonald in TV's Coronation Street did a very passable Scottish accent, and physically he was pretty good too.
Hmm. Well, Ian, thank you so much for your time, as always.
No, I appreciate it, Vic. Thanks to you, man.
It's always a pleasure to talk to Ian Rankin. Don't go away. We've got the best of the Book Nook coming your way right after this. The Book Nook continues today with a Best of the Book Nook segment recorded back in 1996. I interviewed the Jesuit priest Malachy Martin. Let's listen now to him talking about Windswept House, a Vatican novel. Malachy, you're one of those guests where I could sit here for an hour or two and we could hardly cover any ground.
That's right.
I think we need to talk a little bit more about the book. You make some very strong statements in the book.
Yes.
Statements to the effect that there are a number of high-ranking church members who are not in service to God, but they are in service to the prince of darkness, Lucifer.
Lucifer.
Is this something that you really believe?
It's not something I believe. It's a belief. I reserve belief for that act of faith and trust. I believe you are an honest man. I believe you have a good will to me and to all men. This is something I know from the evidence. We have the evidence of covens, and they're not in every diocese. Not everybody belongs to them. We mustn't get the Muslim people to church with, but there are diabolists. There are Satanists, as they call them, or Luciferians. They prefer themselves. They've ceased to believe in Christ a long time ago, ceased to believe in the supernatural, but they do belong to a gilt-edged membership club with the limousines and the prestige, and why should they give it up? And please kiss my ring, son or daughter. It is a position of power. But they also have made a compromise with Lucifer, who is a real being. He's not a mythical animal with large ears and dirty yellow eyes and filthy books under his arm saying, psst, come behind the bushes and commit sin with me. No, no, no. And it's not Mephistopheles holding up a scroll and saying, give me your soul for 50 years and you can have wine, women, and song in that 50 years. No, it's a different thing completely. There are a body of men and women who have found, by reason, that behind this universe there's an intelligence, there must be, running it all. It's not God. They cease to believe in him, if they ever did. And they find that if they cultivate a being called Lucifer, who is known in the human history of the human race, that he will help them in their worldly ambitions, provided they assist in the advancement of his kingdom. And the advancement of his kingdom is the liquidation of anything like religion as such. So we have the Luciferian Coven, the Satanist Coven. We have the Satanist International, which is a recognized body of men and women. And in a place like New York or Atlanta or Chicago or Boston or Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Rome, Milano, Torino, Tokyo, we have the covens of Luciferians. They're not, by the way, rough men hiding in ditches. No, these are all brokers and doctors and lawyers who find that this satisfies something in them, their desire for power. Are there many? No, they're not. They're not many. But they are powerful. There's no doubt about that. And they are very fervent. They have a tradition in their tradition, which is an old tradition, by the way. It goes very far back past the Middle Ages, as we call it in our scheme of history, that there will come a time towards the end of the second millennium when the prince, if he becomes enthroned in the citadel of the weak one, the nameless one, because that's the satanic name for Jesus, that he will reign for 1,000 years. And therefore there was an attempt at enthroning Satan, enthroning Lucifer, in the Vatican in 1963. It hasn't been completed yet, but neither has it been got rid of. And this explains an awful lot.
And this is all in the book.
That's all in the book. Oh, yeah. That's,
yes.
That's all in the book, because it's a key thing. You see, if I could get any of our listeners or yourself for the moment to put yourself in the position of a man like me. I'm a believer. I'm really a fuddy-duddy. I'm always telling people I'm a dyed-in-the-wool tradition. I really am. I believe it all, live it all as best I can. Okay. If you're like that, then you know there's such a thing. There's nature all around us. We belong to nature. And there's the supernatural which has come to us through Christ. All right. Now, that, from 1965 on, suddenly that supernatural grace disappeared largely from the Roman Catholic organization as such. Not from Roman Catholics themselves, talking about it as an organization, what you call the organizational institute, or the institutional organization of the church, composed of dioceses and parishes and universities and colleges and order, religious orders, the big major religious orders, Jesuits, Dominicans, Carmelites, Franciscans, and all the orders of nuns. Suddenly something went wrong, went awry. They left in droves, and they changed overnight. They became secularized. They became anti-papal. They stopped... They went crazy about things. Then homosexuality spread amongst them. It was an amazing change. And people who are acquainted with Luciferian behavior know that's the effect of Lucifer's presence. He wipes out grace. He wipes out good behavior. He liquidates vocations. He dissolves celibacy. He hates virginity. And so on and so forth. So that change we see from 1965 to 1995 is a perfect reflection of the absence of supernatural grace and the invasion of it in the heart of the church by Lucifer. It's as simple as that. That's why the Holy Father, the present Holy Father, at times used to say, not in my hearing, but in the hearing of friends of mine who work with him, I wonder what went wrong that it's gone so badly. It's gone so badly. What went wrong? Something went wrong. That jiggered the whole thing, because it is jiggered. It is jiggered. Nothing seems to go right. Nothing. He has had meeting after meeting abroad, international conventions for the evangelization of Latin America, for the conversion of Europe. He's had meetings of youth in Częstochowa, Poland, and in St. James of Compostela in Spain, all over. Nothing seems to work. There's no vibrancy. There's nothing happening. On the contrary, there's this level, vertical dropping of all the leading indicators every year, and every year it's worse. It's worse, except for annulments and the amount of people leaving the church en masse. And, you know, 250 New Yorkers and people in the Tri-State area came out to listen to John Paul II in the rain when he came to New York the last time. And afterwards they went around with a microphone saying, do you like your foot? They said, we love him. A lot of them were Hispanics, a lot of them were not. They were Irish and Italian, etc. And they said, well, what do you think about his stand on abortion? Oh, I don't agree with that. I don't agree about abortion or contraception, but he's our Pope. So there's this love and veneration for a peer figure, which he is. And he's a very lovable man, by the way. Personally, I adore this man personally. He's benign and fatherly and friendly and kind and understanding and forgiving as a personal, as a person. There's no doubt about that. It's just that at the end of this book, when you read it, you do come to the conclusion, yes, that he is most lovable and most compassionate, but that simply his governance of the church has been lousy. If I could use that word like that, with all due respect, it's been awful, and it's gone to bits. The apostasy is very complete, and millions have been led out of Catholic faith by the nose and don't know it, because he hasn't corrected the teaching. He has not corrected the teaching.
So there's been this downward spiral since Pope John the 23rd through Paul the 6th.
That's right.
What happened with John Paul the 1st?
It is impossible to say that John Paul the 1st died a natural death. It is impossible. Now, why do I say that? Well, I'll tell you very briefly. Once upon a time, I was just talking about this with a friend of mine today. The papacy was so strong in Europe. By the way, every country in Europe paid tribute to the papacy. And the papacy had tax collectors going on all year on collecting it. And when a pope died, all commerce stopped, because the Vatican man had to stamp everything at the tariffs and the customs. So it was very powerful. result was a pope's life was invaluable. So when a pope died or was supposed to have died, they surrounded it with protocol to make sure he died or wasn't killed, and who killed him, who did. The death of a pope was surrounded by protocol. And actually, the rules for the death, when a pope is even ill, mortally ill, it's hemmed in by rules that everybody is governed by, down to the time they put his body into the grave. Now, if you examine the way John Paul I, it's impossible to unravel it. He was embalmed. There were three autopsies, two of them after he had been embalmed. And we don't know who found him dead. We don't know, was he clothed or in bed? We don't know what he was holding. We don't know what time he died. Nothing is sure. It's all confusion. That is impossible according to normal Vatican protocol. If you read the way Pius XII, Pacelli, died, he died at about 3:10 in the morning in Castel Gandolfo. We know exactly everything that happened from that until we buried him in the crypt of the popes. But in John Paul I, no. There's something fishy. Now, after
that...
He
sure wasn't pope very long.
34 days. 34 days.
That was very strange.
I remember I used to go to breakfast to a small eatery called Clark's on 3rd Avenue at that time. There was a big fat lady there, an Irish lady, a small little fat lady who was giving me my breakfast every morning. She knew what I was in. So I went in that morning when John Paul II had been found dead, and they already knew it over the radio. And I said, Mary, what do you think happened to the Holy Father? She said, they're trying to tell us he died. Well, we know what they did to him. Mary had no means of knowing. But her instinct told her there was something fishy about the whole thing. And he did write a letter to Cardinal Wyszynski, then Primate of Poland, saying that he had just had a visit from a very great personage called Nikodim. He was a Russian metropolitan. And that Wyszynski had just gone back to Poland after the conclave. And he said, pack your bags, come back, there's going to be another conclave soon. It's a very mysterious letter. Mm. There's something fishy about it. Will we know? You or I won't. No, I'm 75. I'm going to be playing a harp long before you. But even then, I don't think you'll know. Later historians will find out the truth. Somebody will blab. Some evidence will come to light. Here's the point. In reality, when you go around and talk to people and they let their hair down and they know you're not going to... blow the gaff on them, as they say in England. You're not going to start talking about them, but you want to know their mind about things. Most good, middle-of-the-road, conservative clergymen, I'm talking about those alone, are in desperation. Why? Well, they have to get their monthly salary. They have to have their insurance. We know two important things in life. All their life they've been clerics, and they've obeyed what the bishops told them and what Rome says, the official Rome says. And now they know that it isn't working, nothing is working, and they're losing ground. And what are they to do? What can they do now that they know the system doesn't work? It isn't working, that's all. They're not gaining ground, they're losing ground. They're not even holding their own. And around them there's confusion and chaos because the amount of sects, S-E-C-T-S, not sex, but sects that there are, and the amount of cults and breakaway bishops and breakaway clergy, and breakaway nuns, they're multiplying, not only in this country, but in Canada and abroad in Europe too. It is breaking up into fragments, like a lot of corks floating around in a vast bucket and clustering together and then breaking away with the waves and clustering again, and disorder and disunity. And John Paul II is presiding over all that in a certain sense that he's the Pope, and if he travels to a place, we all go out and say God bless the Pope and serve his Mass and kiss his ring, etc., and give him veneration. Of course we do, because he is Pope. He was validly elected Pope. But the question is, how do I save my own soul? Who's right? Where's the truth? And all those prayers we used to learn, and all those actions, the ritual actions we used to have, are they all useless now? And is singing with balloons, you know, at the present moment, if in certain churches I went down in Bermuda shorts carrying a parrot on my shoulder and with colored balloons and started into a mass of Holy Sophia, I'd be welcomed. If I went down in a square Roman alb and chasuble and started off in Truibur Altare Dei, they would call a policeman. They would, they do. They will have nothing to do with it. The confusion and chaos is so great, and the anger. I know priests who counsel their young men who say they can't go to the new Mass, they say, well, go to an Episcopal Mass. Don't go to the old Mass, whatever happens. With that amount of confusion, abroad in the land and in Canada and in Europe, there's no unity. So what do you do? What do you do? Well, this is a vade mecum. This is a thing which will tell you what you can do in safe conscience and still have hope that you are saved in the Church of Christ. That's the idea of the book. It's a short book. It's about 180 pages. Nothing like this one.
Yes, this is a long book, 640-some pages.
It's very hard to get everything into that, by the way. Do you know that? Because it's a whole... This life of the Slavic Pope entwines globalism and the New World Order. There's no doubt about that. And you see, the Catholic Church is a very desirable object for a lot of people. Why? Because it is a social stabilizer. It is stabilizing, very stabilizing, provided it doesn't insist on abortion and contraception, provided it doesn't insist on educating the children, provided it doesn't insist on marriage not ending in divorce. If it could only concede those things, it'd be the most beloved place in the wide world, the others say to it. So people want to get control of that and make the Pope come around and say, okay, two-child family or no-child family is better than what we have at the present moment. Get rid of the useless eaters, as they call them, in Thailand and in the Far East and in our big cities, inner cities in America. So they want to get control of it. So globalists do want control, but they don't want to wipe out the Church. They want it as a social, socio-cultural stabilizer, which it is, but minus the knobby parts. The knobby parts, which are the supernatural rules that the Church imposes on its children. That's number one theme. The other theme is the entire meaning of papacy. Should we have a pope, finally, an absolute monarch who claims infallibility, and when he says yes, it's yes, and when he says no, it's no, when he says it under certain conditions? Is that out? Is that gone? John Paul II has said, his view is that the bishops must say so, and then he will agree with them, or they must agree with him. That's not what we call infallibility. That theme is there. Then the whole question of sexuality. What about homosexuality? And so on. There are a gamut of things like that that matter. And then there is this rising, not tremendously high, but a rising cult of Lucifer. It is really a very strong cult. Strong not in numbers, but in quality. That is, the people who join it have money and are sincere about it, very sincere and very keen on it. And it is dead against everything the Church holds. Then there is Freemasonry, the Lodge, as we call it, some of which is very sympathetic to the Catholic Church, some of which is very anti. And in that book there is one man, he's really the hero of the book in a certain sense.
Gibb.
Yeah, who is a Freemason, and a very loyal Freemason too. He's a practicing Mason. And he is modeled on a person I know. He's not a fictional character. He's a man whom I love an awful lot. He's genuinely a good man. Gibson Appleyard is the name he has in the book. But he's a great friend of the Pope's. But he also is a very, very fervent Freemason. And so that's a theme coming into it, because they say that there are only two companions that will last forever in this universe of ours. Their footprints will always be beside each other on the sands of time, Christianity and Judaism. There's a third, Masonry. There's a third. Behind or in front or beside, I don't know where. But it's there. It's a third footprint in the sands of time. We'll always be there.
You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook, a special extra segment there. That was Malachy Martin, recorded back in 1996. He was a Jesuit priest, and his book was called Windswept House, a Vatican Novel. He died 3 years after that interview, and I looked that up. He was talking about Lucifer and Satan worshipers. And according to this Wikipedia entry, it says, Malachy Martin died of an intracerebral hemorrhage due to a fall in his apartment in Manhattan in 1999, 4 days after his 78th birthday. It was cited in the documentary Hostage to the Devil that he was pushed from the stool he was standing on by a demonic force. Malachy Martin, a fascinating, very unusual man, highly intelligent. He performed hundreds of exorcisms. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Tune in tomorrow at 10:30 tomorrow morning when my guests will call in from Stockholm, Sweden. They call themselves Lars Kepler.